Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler, and I'd like to welcome all of you to my brand new program, the Michael Cutler Hour. I've been filling in for Tom Garcia for this past summer. It's been a privilege to have been the guest host on his program, The American Hour. And for those of you familiar with Tom, you know he's a retired Navy pilot, aviator, as they like to say, Top Gun instructor. He's currently an American Airlines pilot. And my background is in government, but in a slightly different direction. I'm a retired senior special agent of the INS. So lots of what I like to talk about deal with national security, the fact that we cannot win a war on terror or a war on narcotics and transnational gangs without first securing our nation's borders and enforcing the immigration laws that are designed and, in fact, were enacted to protect America and Americans. And today we've got a very unusual program. Besides being my number one program, my first program with the USA Radio Talk Radio Network, we're going to have Tom join us. He is down in Florida, in Orlando, at the CPAC convention, and that's the Conservative Political Action Committee convention. It's always a joy to join Tom. It's always a pleasure to chat with him. I think of him as a good friend, and certainly we are now collaborators on the internet radio business, because we're both motivated by a desire to bring accuracy to the news that all too often is missing from the major news networks. And by the way, what makes things kind of interesting, I'm a registered Democrat. I can't tell you the last time I was happy with where the Democratic Party has gone. I've often remarked that somebody should buy those folks a GPS. But my orientation's a bit more liberal. Tom is a conservative. But as Americans, I respect his right to be a conservative. He respects my right to have the views that I have, because both of us, both Tom and I hate speaking for someone else, but I know him well enough to tell you this without any equivocation, we both want what we believe will ultimately be best for America, best for Americans, best for our children and their children, that also honors the incredible sacrifices, the valor, the gallantry, the commitment of the men and women of our armed services, and they've been there for us ever since the founding of this great nation. And I would also like to add that this is also to honor the sacrifices of the men and women who are the law enforcement officers of America, whether it's the cop on the corner or federal agents or state troopers, the men and women who are the firefighters who run into rescue total strangers out of burning, collapsing buildings, the emergency medical techs who expose themselves to the horrors that they find at work. This is about honoring Americans who do what they can to build and protect our nation and getting away from politics as usual, which has gotten us into this mess. So with that having been said, I'm going to bring Tom on, because, Tom, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program or to be on your program, and it's always delightful to chat with you. Happy Friday to you and everybody out there. How are you today, Tom?
Very good, Michael. Hey, it's great to be doing this. I know this is technically your first broadcast as a Michael Cutler Hour, and here we are at CPAC Live. I'm in the radio row. Steve Rosenblum just finished his radio show, and he's standing in front of me. Why don't we get him on for a second? Next, at the
Absolutely.
Table next to me is Rick Santorum. He just came walking. And Herb and Kane just sauntered on through, and he's over talking to our good friend Ed Dean, who had me on his radio show about half an hour ago, and I got to plug our radio show. So
Excellent.
Anyway. Yeah, it's busy. It was quiet here about an hour ago, and it's gotten pretty busy. But let's get Steve Rosenblum over here to say hi and tell us about what he's going on, or what he's doing and what's going on. And I know you know Steve, so
yep.
we'll get that little plug in there real quickly. But Steve, Michael Cutler's on the line. You're not going to be able to hear him, but we're talking to him. Just tell us what you're doing with your radio show and what's going on in the future.
Well, we just finished broadcasting live. We had one of Herman Cain's grassroots supporters on the show, Suzanne Moore. We did a little analysis of the debate. I gave my perspective from the media room, which was a little different. I was sitting next to Byron York while he was live tweeting it and getting very upset with the Google Lounge, which was out of sync with the rest of the coverage. So you had... you're listening to the debate and you're in front of you, and then out of your right ear, you can hear the debate again out of sync. So that was kind of annoying to him. met with Stephen Cruiser of PJTV, the new media represented, Andrew Breitbart, saw Howard Kurtz looking very disheveled from CNN's quote, reliable sources.
Very good. Well, remind people where they can listen to you, when you broadcast during the week, where do they go to listen to you?
All right, CRF weekdays broadcast 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern on the USA Talk Radio Network, and, of course, at Blog Talk Radio. And Conservative Republican Forum airs on Saturday evenings from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Steve. All right, that's our good friend, Steve Rosenblum. And there's
you know, I met Steve when I was doing a different radio program, and I was a guest on his show. He was a guest on my show. And about 2 weeks ago, I had dinner with Steve here in New York.
Yeah, yeah, he remembers you, and
he's
does
a good
great
friend,
show
and he does a great job as a talk show host.
Now, we've got one of the senatorial candidates coming that I talked with yesterday. Let's see if we can get her over here. Do you want to come over and talk
sure.
now? Okay. Her name is Mary, so we'll have to tell people. We just kind of have to grab people when we can, and if it interrupts our normal flow, it's just the way it is. But Mary Ellen Stewart, she's a Republican candidate for United States Senate 2012. We want to get rid of Bill Nelson in a big way, and he's just such a mediocre senator. But Mary Ellen Stewart, how are you today? Now, we're broadcasting from here as well as New York right now, so unfortunately I don't have another headset for you, but that's okay. You and I are going to chat. This is all being broadcast live on USA Talk Radio Network, and it's also going to be archived on iTunes and on the website, so I'll make sure I give you a card so that you can go, if you want to download that, use that for your purposes. But in any case, introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them why, what your background is and why you're running for Senate. And just because it's noisy in here, I got this tuned down a little bit, so just make sure you know.
Good afternoon. My name is Maria Elena Stewart. I'm running for the United States Senate from the state of Florida, and I am what Ronald Reagan used to call a citizen politician. I have stepped forward to run for office because I feel it is crucial, it is absolutely critical that we change the makeup of the U.S. Senate. There is no question that we're going to put a Republican president in the White House in 2012, but if we do not change the makeup of the Senate and bring some true conservatives in, we're going to experience gridlock. Now, I call myself the true conservative in this U.S. Senate race. I have been a conservative long before it was popular to be a conservative. So my values are very, very firm, and not just a conservative in terms of fiscal responsibilities and fiscal ideas, but also in terms of social ideas. I'm a conservative columnist, so I have a lot of experience writing about these issues, which also makes me quite different, because when you look at the other candidates, they claim that they're conservative, but then you look at their voting record or what they were doing 2-3 years ago, and you find that they were not voting in a conservative way. When you look at my record, it is all written through my conservative columns. You can view them, you can read them in Renew America, which is a conservative political website, Renew America. And I write about China, our military capabilities versus the Chinese. There is a series titled The Beijing Affair, which I began earlier this year, where I do an analysis of where are we in terms of our military capabilities and what the Chinese are doing? Where are we in terms of our economy and what the Chinese are doing across the world? You know, they are controlling Eurasia, and anyone who controls Eurasia is controlling the world. These are things that Americans need to pay attention to. So I am running because this greatest of countries is in danger. And citizen politicians need to step forward the way that Ronald Reagan used to say. I was born and raised in Cuba. I lived under communism. I know firsthand what socialism and communism is about. And socialism is what we are experiencing right now in Washington. America needs to wake up. We are really at a point where we have reached the precipice. And unless we take action and we really enforce our true conservative values, which really were the values that this great country was founded on, we're going to lose America. So there is no time to waste. I feel that this great country gave me freedom and put its constitution for me and for my family to be able to live freely and without a government that would restrict what we could say and what we could do, which is what you experience under socialism and communism. It is time to give back, and this is my way of giving back. There's no greater country than the United States of America. I have a tremendous interest in addressing our economic situation. Our economy is completely tied to our national security. We are at risk. A couple of weeks ago, it was very quietly addressed by the Italian press, Corriere della Sera, which is an Italian newspaper, that Hezbollah has opened a training camp in Cuba. That's Hezbollah with a training camp 90 miles from the coast of Florida. How do Floridians feel about that? And how do Floridians feel about an economy that is really putting our national security at risk? These are the issues I want to address. I also want to address a very vital issue of life. I am pro-life. I'm a solid pro-lifer. And we need to understand that our social security system needs to be helped, and it needs to be there for people who have paid into it. But why is the social security system also hurting? It's also hurting because there are over 50 million Americans that died through abortion and that were never able to contribute to social security. So when I say I'm a true conservative, I am a true conservative. And I'm able to articulate all of these issues on the Senate floor, and I plan to, with the support of the wonderful people of Florida. It's time that Bill Nelson end his career as a politician. I also support term limits. I believe that I should go in, have a maximum of two terms, and then let someone else take over and hopefully continue the good work that I did.
Michael, did you have any questions?
Yes, I certainly understand her position. You know, she and I would disagree. You know, I'm pro-choice only because I don't believe the government should get involved with medical decisions, and I see that differently. But everything else she says said I agree with. But here's my question: she is an immigrant to this country, a lawful immigrant. How does she feel about the issue of immigration?
Okay, good question. Now, you're an immigrant to this country, and I love the fact that you got to actually, I mean, I feel bad for you, but you got to see firsthand, as many of my friends have that I know in South Florida, as Cubans, former Cubans, you know, got to understand what it's like to live in such an oppressive government. So I appreciate that you have that experience and insight. What would you like to see happen with our immigration policies in the U.S.?
I am the daughter of a former political prisoner. I am the niece of one of the longest-held political prisoners in the Western Hemisphere. I am the niece of a man who was sentenced to death by Castro. I know what hunger and political persecution is. I know what it is to wake up every day and leave the house and have my school books torn apart because the local Communist Party was wondering if I had anti-communist materials. And I'm saying this because when people come to the United States, many of them come looking for freedom, and they want to escape poverty. I escaped all of that. I escaped poverty, I escaped hunger, and I escaped political persecution. But I did so legally. I waited my turn. My family and I waited our turn. We had to file documentation, and we entered the United States of America legally. Now, I understand that there are wonderful people that come here that are getting away from poverty in situations that are just terrible. And I do think that we need to have a benevolent attitude. However, we have to observe our immigration laws. We cannot just simply ignore the laws that we have. We cannot allow every few years an administration to come in and give amnesty, and in doing so, rewarding illegal behavior. So I believe that we are a sovereign nation. We have the right to protect our borders. We must do so immediately. It is really a question of national security. And we have to apply the immigration laws that we have in existence.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well,
you know, by the way,
you
know what's interesting, and you could, if you could pass this along to her, you know, my mother came to America ahead of the Holocaust. So it's amazing that if we were to focus on what makes us more similar than different, so many of our citizens, so many Americans, as diverse as we may appear to be on the outside, on the inside, we're a lot more alike than most people would immediately imagine. Wouldn't you agree with that, Tom?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that Mary Ellen would. Let me make sure I see her. Mary Elena, did I get that right? Okay. And I know quite a few people that came from Cuba, and sort of like what you're talking about. In fact, one of the check stand ladies at the Publix grocery store that I go to, her name is Olga. And the first time I saw, she's got white hair and she's fair-skinned, and I thought maybe she was from Europe. And then one day I heard her talking to the bag boy in Spanish, in very fluent Spanish. And I said, where are you from? And she said, Cuba. And then I said, oh, Olga, okay, I get it. She just traveled back to Cuba for the first time in, I think, 25 years and said she was horrified in how terrible things are right now. I mean, just horrified. So if anybody out there thinks that socialism is the answer, they got it absolutely wrong. But Michael and I both agree with you that, and I'm supposed to be a radio host. I don't care. I agree with people that I agree with, and we need a good, strong immigration policy, strong borders, and we need to protect our citizens and think about them first, absolutely. And I applaud you for standing in line and doing what it took to get into this country legally. I applaud you. I don't know what else to say. Michael, do you have anything else to ask our guest?
No, I think that's good. But, you know, what's interesting is she might find this interesting, and the information about Hezbollah in Cuba, realize there were terrorist training camps in Brazil, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Al-Qaeda. We have Iranian shock troops in Iran. This thing about Cuba is, quite frankly, something that I had heard rumors of, but I wasn't certain of it, and I'm starting to believe it is absolutely accurate. So when you look at the pressures that are being applied to America from groups that want to do us in, I don't think there's ever been a more important time in the history of this country for the borders to be secured and the immigration laws to be enforced. And I certainly respect and admire her position, and I wish her the best of luck.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Well, listen, thank you for joining us now. Just tell us real quickly where people can find out more about your campaign, where they should go on the Internet, Facebook, Twitter, Internet website, whatever it is, phone numbers, anything you want to give out, email.
Yes. The listeners can go to my website, which is Marielena Stewart for U.S. Senate 2012.com. And I'm going to spell that. That's Marielena, one word, Marielena, and Stewart with a U, Stuart. Or you can simply type Marielena Stewart 2012.com. You will see a very different political website because I am a conservative columnist. I write, so I write my platform, my positions. I give the viewer or the reader a lot of information. I have positions on the economy, on life and family, on defense. So it's a very thorough website that I think you will enjoy. And I also update it through the In Touch blog to just stay in touch with my followers and my supporters as to my campaign activities. And my email is Marielena Stewart, Marielena Stuart, @gmail.com.
Marielena Stewart, all right, I'm going to turn it over to you, Michael, for a while here, and while I say goodbye to Marielena, but I thought that was fun. We'll be back, and I'll be back in just a moment.
Okay, just jump back on when you want to come back on. You know, this is really an exciting situation that we're in, folks. For the longest time, I've wanted to do a program like this. You know, I've done a lot of television, and I've been on other people's radio programs, and I hope to continue to be on programs and television, but radio is really, to my thinking, the best medium in the world, and I'll tell you why. When you get on television, and those of you who watch TV, you know what the news is like. You come on, you have about 2 minutes and 40 seconds or 3 minutes and 10 seconds to debate somebody on an issue. You're lucky if you get in one or two sentences, and we're off to the races. They break for a commercial, and somebody comes on to talk about a new power tool or about a rainstorm on the other part of the country or whatever it is. Talk radio really provides us with a very unique opportunity to have a conversation. That's really what has been lacking. And for a moment, I just want to talk a little bit about the First Amendment, because it really does come back to this issue. Most people, when you say First Amendment, it's kind of a knee-jerk response. Oh, yes, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. I know about that, freedom of the press. Well, they're right, but there's something else that the First Amendment addresses, and that's the right for people, citizens, to peaceably assemble and to seek redress of grievances. Now, I want you to stop and think about just how critically important that is. This idea of peaceably assembling, our founding fathers did not have an internet, obviously. They had no communications equipment. Their voice could be heard as far away as they were able to scream. Maybe they could cup their hands to their mouth to be heard a little bit further. But the distance their voice carried could be measured in hundreds of feet or maybe 100 yards or whatever the distance is. So if they wanted to have a conversation, if they wanted to have a debate or a discussion, they had to do it face-to-face, nose-to-nose, toe-to-toe. That was the point of peaceably assembling. And the founding fathers of this nation did. They assembled, obviously, in Congress. They assembled in public meeting places. They assembled in schools and churches and synagogues and people's homes, perhaps under a shade tree or in a barn. But the idea was that it was done face to face. Today, we have more opportunities to peaceably assemble. We can do so on radio and television programs. We can do so with the various electronic media. And we can do so on a program like my program, where we're able to peaceably assemble and have discussions and discourse. And we should never, ever be afraid to have a disagreement with our fellow Americans. It's our birthright. It should be civil. It should be respectful. I'm disgusted with the food fights that go on. I'm tired of the accusations and the name-calling. We are better than that. We are more mature than that. And I got to tell you, you may not agree with my positions, and that's fine. You don't have to. But we need to be respectful of each other. For far too long, Americans have been bullied by people who have engaged in name-calling and making accusations. I can't tell you, especially in the beginning, how many times I was accused of being anti-immigrant and a bigot and a racist. And when you would ask people why, they would say, well, you want to secure the border. You don't like immigrants. It was very, very tough to listen to that nonsense, because nothing could be further from the truth. As an immigration agent, I saw the harm that was done to all people living in this country, including members of the immigrant community, especially the members of the immigrant community. So when
Michael, sorry to interrupt. We've got here, Matt Falconer, good friend of mine. He ran for Orange County mayor. And he may be getting into another race. He's got an interesting twist on why he's going to get into the race. I'll let him explain it to you. But if there's anybody that knows how to scale down government, whether it's at the local level, all the way up to the federal level, this is the guy. He's written books on it, fantastic patriot, and really does understand government and how to make it more efficient. And he's exactly the kind of guy we got to get in there. But I'll let you let him tell you his story about how he's going to eliminate. He's already working for the governor. I think actually for the Senate, the state Senate, a task force. So for the state of eliminating redundant agencies and paring down our state government. So I'll let you tell. I'll let him tell you a little bit about that, and also an idea that he came up with for running for office.
I just have to tell you this, and you were with the government, albeit in the military. Tell me what you think of this, because I just got back from a speaking engagement in Washington where I was before the military and so forth. And here's the difference between government and the private sector. In the government, you're rewarded for finding complex solutions to simple problems, whereas in most cases in the private sector, you're rewarded for the opposite, finding simple solutions to complex problems. How does that work for you, Tom?
Yeah, exactly. And Matt can tell you all about that. But I'm gonna
and that's what I would love to hear.
Let him tell us about some of what's going on and what he's been working on.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear it.
Thank you, Tom. And we really need more citizen candidates like you, Tom, people that are going to serve the people and not special interests. So it's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show, as always. I'm working on the Government Efficiency Task Force, which is a 15-member agency or panel, five elected officials and 10 lay people, and our job is to find and eliminate waste in government. Government efficiency, a lot of people think it's an oxymoron, but there's always room for improvement. And a lot of the ideas we come up with, working on toll agency consolidation. We've got four toll agencies in Florida. They basically all do the same thing, and there's a lot of crony capitalism. So we're trying to find a way where we consolidate the administration of that, giving local authority or input without the crony capitalism that comes along with it. So it's a complicated problem, but there's always a simple solution to a complicated problem, just like you said. The other idea I came up with was to do away with the Office of Property Tax Collector. We now have a tax collector that collects your tax money and a property appraiser that sends you the bill. So the property appraiser can just send out one more piece of paper and says, here's the bill, and check off in a box that you've done that money. And while that seems a very simple thing, we spend $250 million a year in Florida on our tax collector. So we could save anywhere between $100 and $250 million a year by consolidating those two agencies. And one of the functions that the tax collector does is the division of motor vehicles. And we all know how that works for us. We've all been there. We know the service and the delays. And really what I propose is to outsource and privatize that. You take a company like AAA that can run that agency and knows about customer service. So instead of walking in and seeing a big line and a bunch of chairs that are uncomfortable, you have Starbucks coffee and aroma, and you have services, and people like that. You have Fast Pass. Maybe pay another $5 to go right up to the window or something like that. So there are ways to get around this. There are solutions out there. The problem is, nobody's really trying to get it done. The politicians, elected officials, are more interested in serving their special interests to get their money for the next campaign.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly what Matt's been up to for some time, and he's been involved in a lot of different organizations, task forces, whether it be Tea Party groups, Patriot groups, as well as just actually getting involved with the government, going to city hall meetings, to county commission meetings, et cetera. But, Matt, thanks for stopping by. Always a pleasure to talk with you, and we'll be in touch. Good luck. All right, that was Matt Falconer. He ran for Orange County mayor, and it's just too bad he didn't get elected because he would have done a fantastic job there.
You know what's so funny? I was listening to the way he was describing the way that the tax collection system works in Florida. And you know what it reminds me of? I don't know if you remember when we chatted about this, Tom, but back in 2002, I was called by Sheila Jackson Lee, who, by the way, at the time was the ranking Democrat on the Immigration Subcommittee, because two of the dead terrorists, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, had been granted authorization to change immigration status, catch this, 6 months after 9/11. And back then, and I think they're still doing it, immigration did not send out their own correspondence to people. I was an adjudicator for a year, and at the end of the day, I would take a piece of paper, check off whatever the appropriate box was, and by hand write any message that we needed to send out to the person we were corresponding with, whether we approved an application, didn't approve it, needed additional documentation. It wasn't hard to print the single sentence by hand and say, please submit another copy of your marriage license or your birth certificate. Instead, what the government did was to ship that whole operation, I believe it was to Texas, where some computerized network was involved, costing I don't know how many millions of dollars to the taxpayers, and the efficiency was so screwed up that here we were 6 months after the attacks, that agency sent authorization to two dead terrorists telling them that they could attend flight school, of all things, in the United States. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's gone on with that, and it hasn't gotten a whole lot better. But
no, it really hasn't. And think how this endangers our safety, folks. It's not just about the money. It's about incompetence. You know, there are three ways you can mess up a job. There's nonfeasance, which means that you just don't do your job. There's misfeasance, which means you do it, and you do it improperly. And there's malfeasance, which means that you screw up your job, but you do so because you're taking money or you're doing something else that would constitute a crime for your actions. And we really have got to clean house on the city level around the country, on every state, and certainly Washington is prime time for that kind of reform. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I would. Sorry, I'm watching our governor over talk to Ed Dean in his radio station. It caused a big crowd over there. And I'm writing something down for one of our guests, but I'll be right back with you, Michael.
Okay, that's fine. You know, just to finish the thought that I started before Tom came on with that excellent guest, and it's kind of difficult to coordinate this, folks. It's like having a phone conversation with one of your good friends, and they keep coming back and forth on the phone because we can't communicate with each other otherwise. But I do want you to understand how important discourse is, how important getting accurate information out there is. And that's really what's been lacking for far too long. And I don't know that the media has a liberal bias, but I certainly believe that for the most part, the media has a corporate bias. There are lots of organizations that don't want the borders secured. There are lots of organizations that want to provide amnesty to millions of illegal aliens. We know nothing about these folks. We do not know their nationality. We certainly don't know their names. But yet, incredibly, this administration and politicians from both parties have said that they want to provide these millions of illegals with lawful status and a pathway to citizenship. Well, think about how many people could make money off of that deal. Let's start with the immigration attorneys. I don't know if you folks know this, but a couple of years ago, 2007, the last time they tried to pass comprehensive immigration reform, back when I wrote a commentary for the Washington Times when I called comprehensive immigration reform the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. In fact, Senator Sessions from Alabama honored me by quoting me and my article from the floor of the Senate on three separate days during the floor debate. But understand how wacky this whole business has gotten. Because back then, that law would have paid the legal fees for the illegal aliens if they went to an attorney. Aliens coming legally have to pay for the lawyers. When you go to your tax preparer, you have to pay for the services, but that law would have given the attorneys the money that they would be billing the government to process the applications for people who shouldn't have been here in the first place. So when you look,
it's amazing.
Are you there, Tom?
Hey, Michael, I'm back. Here's an interesting twist for you.
Go ahead.
I had somebody the other day explain to me that we're running out of Americans to do certain jobs, so we're going to have to give amnesty to Hispanics. I mean, now that's the big population of the Southwest that are coming across the border, because there just aren't going to be enough white Americans, black Americans to do certain jobs. And so I went and calculated how many of those Americans actually do exist, and this is all psychobabble baloney that the amnesty proponents and apologists put out there. When you run any of these numbers that they try and cite without giving you actual numbers, they never add up. There are tens and tens of millions of Americans looking for work, better work, and available to work in any of these jobs that these folks were telling me. Because what I had said to this one individual was, if you give amnesty to all these folks, they're going to immediately unionize and the cheap labor's gone. And he said, well, it doesn't matter. It's not about cheap labor. It's that we're just running out of people to do the work. I find that just to be total hogwash. It doesn't add up.
Well, it's not even whether they unionize. You know, you and I might disagree about unions. There are certain unions that I don't much care for either. But my dad was a construction worker. He belonged to a trades union. I'm a big fan of the trades unions, provided that the trades union doesn't favor illegal immigration, because then they're undercutting their own workers and their workers' salaries and so forth. But I will tell you, the last amnesty of 1986, one of the most remarkable things that we witnessed, I had many informants who were out there, and one of them, a guy by the name of Juan, he was from Mexico. He was married to an American woman. He had a child with her. This was a legitimate marriage. I did help him get the paperwork processed more quickly, because he did help us quite a bit, and his wife did as well. But he was working in a restaurant, and he came to me, and this was just around the time that he got his green card. So as soon as he went to work, this was around the time of the amnesty, he and three or four of his good buddies on the job went to the employer and said, look, I'm going to keep working for you, but I'm not going to work for $3.50 an hour. That's what they were getting back then in 1986. He said, I have my green card. I want you to pay me a living wage. I want to get the money that I should be getting. This should be a $10 an hour job. And I mean, $10 an hour is not exactly living in the lap of luxury even back then, but that was what they asked for. And they would have been entitled to it if this guy had paid prevailing wages. So what do you think he did? He fired those five guys and brought in illegal aliens who no doubt are now part of this next wave who are demanding to get lawful status because they've been here.
Yeah.
So you're exactly right, Tom. Once you legalize folks, you can't exploit them. They're no longer vulnerable to the thuggish conduct of the employer.
Well, you know, one thing that I think is going on with these unions, they're not too bright, number one. Hey, I'm in a union, and I think that we do some stupid things at times myself, but they think that they're going to increase their union brother and sister roles with this amnesty ploy, and they're always looking for revenue. That's the key. They're always looking for revenue.
Revenue and warm bodies so they can talk about leverage.
There's X number of jobs available right now, so they're only going to be harming their existing, you know, union brothers and sisters. So it's not a smart ploy. And then for the so-called businessmen and capitalists that think they want to exploit, number one, it's immoral to exploit somebody, whether they're legal or illegal, by undercutting, you know, wage laws and wage rules and that kind of thing.
And working conditions. I've seen some hellish conditions in the workplace, let me tell you.
I used to see these sort of amnesty proponent groups that were, you know, primarily made up of Hispanic, you know, type folks, you know, and I can say that because folks like myself that, you know, are American citizens, Hispanic origin, and looking to exploit the opportunity of amnesty by unionizing and, I mean, you know, you talk about unionizing 5 million suddenly new citizens or at least legal residents and at a 1 or 2% skimming off the top of the union wages. I mean, I think I pay 2.5% of my wages to the union right now. That adds up to a lot of money. Now the AFL-CIO Teamsters, they've gotten in on the act and they see that money potential there. And so they want in. I guarantee you they will immediately unionize. All of the farm workers and others and food industry workers will immediately unionize because there's way too much money to be made in those unions, and the union bosses want that money and want it now and want it fast. So, again, as far as cheap labor goes, cheap labor disappears now. What may happen, and I'm not sure exactly how this will play out, but you may have businesses that say, wow, they unionized really quick. I didn't see that coming. I don't want to pay union wages, and then they do like what happened to your father, and they hire new illegals, and they tell them, I'll hire you as long as you don't unionize, and because they're illegal immigrants, you know, they have to kind of stay in the shadows or whatever, and so you have now a black market of workers in order to avoid the unionization issue.
Well, you know, what was really funny, until they passed immigration reform, and they said that now we'd go after the employers, which pleased us back then, but we never really pursued these cases the way we should have, we would have unscrupulous employers, picture this, call us up and tell us that they had illegal aliens in their factories, because before 1986 it was not a crime to intentionally hire an illegal alien. And you'd go in and say, well, why do you want me to arrest these people? Well, they're unionizing. So they would say, those five guys need to be arrested, but the other 73 illegals in my factory, you need to leave them alone. So, of course, I would come equipped with a search warrant and a bunch of wagons, and we would take all the illegals out of the factory. You know, this whole idea of using the government enforcement mechanism to act as a goon squad for unscrupulous employers used to turn me purple with rage, and I wasn't alone in this. But the problem now is that we have an administration that will go after the employers and not go after the illegal aliens. And this is something that I don't understand why none of the candidates have been addressing thus far, although I did miss the debate last night. I did see where Mitt Romney made a number of excellent points. Someone sent me a link to part of it. And I'm going to put it out there, by the way, folks. And most likely, if you're listening to both Tom and myself today, then you know my website. It's michaelcutler.net. But in case you don't know about it, if someone just sent you a link, please go to michaelcutler.net. Or you can also go to a great website, capsweb.org, Californians for Population Stabilization. I'm a senior fellow with them, and we've seen what happened to California. Their economy is in free fall. But, you know, I've been writing about this for the longest time, that if we don't do what we're supposed to do, we are losing control over the workplace, and the administration is doing nothing but exacerbate it. Because what they just did was to give lawful status to 300,000 illegal aliens who were under deportation proceedings. They stopped the deportation hearings for 300,000 illegal aliens and said, well, it's not permanent, but at least temporarily, we're going to give you employment authorization. And just about a week ago, Obama went before a Hispanic group, and I love how everybody that does this wants to make illegal immigration an Hispanic issue. There are millions of illegal aliens in the country, folks, who are not Latinos. As an immigration agent, I've arrested people from almost every planet on every country on this planet. But in any event, Obama went before a Latino audience and said that he wished he had a magic wand to enact the DREAM Act. And you really need to see what Mitt Romney had to say about what Governor Perry has been doing in Texas about this business. Because, you know, if you look at providing in-state tuition for kids who shouldn't be in the country, while American children can't afford to go to college, you know, it's not that I'm anti-anybody, but I am pro-American. And that means Americans who are Latino, Americans who are black, Americans who are of Asian descent, and Americans such as myself who are perhaps of either European descent or Eastern European descent. It doesn't matter. We are all Americans. Every color of the rainbow is represented among our people. So when people make this into a race issue, it's not. It's simply about distinguishing citizen from non-citizen and making certain that the government really is government of the people. It's not of the people when it's looking out for corporations and the special interest groups and ignoring the majority of the citizens of the United States of America. That's a betrayal of our people. It's also a betrayal of the Constitution, as I understand it. Would you want to comment on that? Am I getting that wrong, Tom? I think we may have lost Tom. I'm not sure.
No, I'm back. We just had two more guests show up. We got somebody from the Madison Institute, and
okay.
Right now we got Larry Walters from the Fair Tax. I know this is a whole different subject, but
that's
it's
fine.
A very intriguing subject. And, you know, your whole presentation is on how illegal immigration is costing us so much money is fantastic. And this is a whole other aspect now about
sure.
how to really turn our economy around in the short term and long run is the Fair Tax. So I'm going to let Larry introduce himself, talk about it, and then I've got a few questions for him. They're not, you know, they're pretty standard questions. But Larry has been doing this for some time. I've seen him on the road. Numerous times at various conventions and back when I was campaigning, he's been pushing for the Fair Tax quite heavily. So he's what we would call a subject matter expert on the Fair Tax. But in any case, Larry Walters, we're on the Michael Cutler Show. He's in New York, and we appreciate you stopping by to talk to us. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, and hello, Michael. I can't hear you, so you don't need to respond to this.
Okay,
and
fair
I appreciate
enough.
The opportunity to chat with you. Are you going to be answering questions for him? Okay. Well, Mike, Tom introduced me, so I don't need to go into that any longer. I'm a resident of Florida here since 1974, moving down from Connecticut. I had always been a flat tax supporter since about 1985 or so, when Bill Archer and Dick Armey were promoting that big time, and I was really quite devastated when they decided to just kind of drop it and let it die, except for Armey, who's got a flat tax going through the FreedomWorks organization. I've been doing tax returns for about 50 years now, and I noticed that every time Congress passed some legislation that had the byline and simplify the tax system, it got more complex for me to file, and that kind of kept the interest of getting rid of the IRS and the tax system in my mind somewhat. I had the occasion to start an in-home business and start filing a Schedule C, profit and loss from business, with millions of other Americans. And that's when I really got to thinking again about this is really a pain in the neck. And the thoughts of repealing the income tax system surfaced again. And about 10, 15 years into that, my dad died. I inherited his house, and I turned it into a rental. And all of a sudden, I was filling a Schedule Form E. And, that just complicated my tax returns every year. And then I sold that property, and I was facing a capital gains tax. And that was the smoking gun for me. along the way, I happened to hear Neil Bortz, another talk show host, talking about this fair tax thing. And that's all it was to me at the time. But it struck some interesting chords. And I started looking into it. This was back in 2005. And the more I looked into it, the more I saw how this is the most sensible tax method we could have. And I got involved. I became a community coordinator down here in Central Florida in the Orlando area. And then subsequently found somebody to replace me as a community coordinator, and I took a position as a district director. So right now I'm responsible for the operations of the entire greater Orlando area, which is a little over 1 million people. And we're doing pretty well, but not as well as we'd like to. I would like to address how the fair tax will have a direct effect on the immigration issue, because I know you're interested in that.
Right.
You've heard of the family consumption allowance, or the prebate portion of the fair tax, or at least I think you have. And if not, you can talk to Tom here. He'll relay the message. But because in order to qualify to receive that family consumption allowance, you have to have two characteristics about yourself. One is you have to be a legitimate resident in the United States. Secondly, you have to have a validated Social Security account. If you don't meet those two criteria, you do not qualify for the family consumption allowance. That being said, we know that illegal aliens, based on the word illegal, do not meet that criteria. So they will not qualify for that allowance, and therefore their cost of life here is going to go up exceedingly high. Also, if they do decide to stay, they'll be paying the fair tax, which is 23 cents out of every dollar, on every dollar they pay from the very first dollar they spend. And even if they're here illegally, they will be contributing to our revenue system, to the federal government. Now, here, that's going to have some byproducts. One is a lot of those residents, those illegals, will decide to deport themselves. How many, we don't know, but we know it'll be some fair numbers. What that means is that the numbers of illegal residents or illegal aliens who are using some of our school facilities, our medical facilities, and our local support facilities will go away. That being said, we know that the tax burden on us will go down because the government will not have to have as much money to support these operations, school, medical, and other social services. So we see that being a benefit that was not planned, but is certainly going to be appreciated. I've gone into the middle of the story here to go after the connected to the illegal immigration issue. If you'd like, I'll back up and give you a quick overview of what the fair tax legislation actually covers.
Sure, let's do that.
Okay.
Good.
I'm going to give you the first line and the last line of the legislation. The fair tax legislation, H.R. 25, S-13 in the Senate, it repeals the entire income tax system. It repeals the code allowing them to enforce an income tax on every form and source of income. Secondly, it defunds the IRS. It takes their budget away in the third year. It gives them 3 years to clean up prosecution that they have that is open from tax evaders. Once that is done, it also calls for the destruction of the records that the IRS held or has on us as citizens of this country. And then the bottom line, the last line, is that it replaces the entire income tax system with a very simple, transparent national sales tax of 23 cents out of the dollar, which means if you go to the store and you buy a loaf of bread for $2, 23 cents out of that, 46 cents out of that $2 is taxed. That gets turned over to the state revenue department because the fair tax is literally administered by the states and it is enforced by the states. No American, again, files a federal tax return. The only businesses that have any tax returns to file are those businesses that sell new goods or services to the end consumer. All products and services, new products and services, are taxed once and one time only when sold to the end consumer. Once tax has been collected on that item, it becomes used. It is no longer taxed under the fair tax legislation as it is written. How does that sound so far?
Well, here's my question. I don't know if you can hear me or not, but you know, and too many years of education, perhaps. But it's always been said that a sales tax is regressive because no matter what your income, you're paying the same amount of tax
sales
for goods
tax
and
being regressive, it is. And we overcome that with the family consumption allowance that I talked about when I was talking about the issue of the illegal aliens.
Now, how does that work?
What the fair tax legislation has done is it takes the poverty level number that is created each year by the Department of Health and Human Services.
Right.
And based on that number for a single person, married couple, and some number of dependents, it calculates 23% of that amount. From that 23% figure, it divides that by 12. And each month, it will the Social Security Administration will disperse either a check or a debit card payment of some kind, debit card credit, so that everybody who is, like I said earlier, a legitimate citizen, or I mean a legitimate resident, and a Social Security account holder will not pay any tax on any of their expenses up to the poverty line for their family size. That's like a $564 check for a married couple with two children. Every month they will get that, paying them in advance for the taxes that they're going to pay for their bread and eggs and butter and transportation and things of that nature.
That's only if they are meet certain poverty levels. So somebody that's – no, every single person will get that. You'll still, okay, so you'll still get that, but then the good news is the billionaire, as you said, is going to spend a whole lot of money and pay a whole lot more tax. I quite honestly, now you tell me if you think this is true, but I've always believed that it ends up being, because it's called the fair tax, it does end up being fair. Wealthy people actually end up paying more. Not that I'm looking to make wealthy people, but they buy very expensive things that you and I will never afford. I think they ultimately, under that versus our progressive income tax system, with all the loopholes, actually end up paying more.
Well, they really do. And actually, because of that, it is a progressive system because the wealthier people do pay more as they live their life normally. Additionally to that, we've got the situation where some people today are getting tax credits for not doing anything, and they'll get the rebate for not doing anything as long as they meet the criteria for it. But that rebate doesn't go very far. And what really is going to happen is that if they spend $1 more than the rebate level, they start contributing to the system also by paying the tax. If any household, for example, spends twice as much money on their lifestyle than the rebate level, now here's the good thing. Their net tax liability is only 11.5% because they had reimbursement for the first for 23% on the first half up to the poverty line. They pay the full 23% on the second half, twice the poverty line. The net across the whole spending spree is only 11.5%. And nobody will ever pay more than 23%.
Well, here's another interesting aspect of this. Let's say I'm a billionaire and I have no income. And I don't have my money invested because it's $1 billion. I don't need to have it invested. So I'm not paying capital gains, I'm not dividends or anything like that. So nothing to tax me on. And I can go out and buy yachts and houses and buy this and buy that my whole life and never even spend all that $1 billion, but I'm not contributing to the system. Under a fair tax, the billionaire who inherits $1 billion or somehow gets his hand on that certain amount of money will pay on that money. As long as he spends it, he'll be paying.
As long as what he's buying is new, he can buy a used yacht that costs $1 million and not pay any tax on it, okay, because it was taxed once already. Now, there's a lot of detail, obviously, that goes into putting the entire package together, but what I've just outlined is the overview, what we're eliminating, what we're putting in its place, how it affects illegal immigration, how it overcomes the regressiveness of a sales tax. And the idea behind the whole flat or fair tax issue is that it was to be a tax that was totally transparent, which this is, which was equally administered to all residents of this country, which it is, and so that there would be no exceptions, so that there would not be any room for loopholes, which is what has convoluted the system we have today. We've got 72,536 pages of IRS regulations and legislation to comply with. Nobody, no human being can do that honestly. The fair tax is 131 pages of legislation. There'll probably be maybe 1,000 pages of regulations to explain how the legislation should be implemented, and that's going to be it. Under the income tax system, Congress can create a loophole or a tax change that will affect only a pocket of society, too small a volume of people to have any power. Under the fair tax, if Congress wants to make a change, it affects every single one immediately. It is very, very visible, and we have a voice of power. And if our Congressman votes for something that is out of the question, out of the ordinary, we'll have the power to put them out of office next election.
That's awesome, Larry. Hey, listen, where can people go to find out more information about this and get educated on all of this?
Thanks for the question. www.fairtax.org. That's the home of Americans for Fair Taxation in Houston, Texas. And no matter where you're listening from, you go to those folks, and most of the papers that were created by these university professors that did the research are available on that website. So you can study this thing up and down, upside and down, and you should be able to understand with some simplicity how great a tool this is going to be for our economy. Just think of our businesses not having any more compliance situations with a tax code that is so convoluted. Think about the money that is no longer being wasted just filing tax returns and keeping records in order to file tax returns. We spend now $430 billion a year just in compliance costs. That money goes away. That's money that businesses will have to invest in new tools, new employees, new ideas, and it is really the best job stimulus that could be offered to the United States today.
By the way, Michael, did you have a question for Larry?
There's a quick question if you can ask him this for me, Tom. There was just an Inspector General report from the IRS about how it's now estimated that last year illegal aliens received $4.2 billion for additional child tax credits. Can you imagine that? $4.2 billion paid to illegal aliens for the additional child tax credits.
Yeah, so they basically got any illegal immigrants that filed a tax return then basically saved via that credit, is what you're saying?
It went from 924 million in 2005 to $4.2 billion last year.
$4.2 billion went back to tax credits to illegal immigrants that did file, so they saved that money. They got that money back. In some cases, they got checks.
Hey, that's incredible. I was not aware of that. I've never been involved in the tax credit side of the business. I've had enough fun just trying to keep up with my own tax returns, Mike.
But how crazy is that?
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to let Larry go. Larry, thanks for stopping by. Good seeing you again. Appreciate the information. Take care. Well, Michael, we got people now backing up and lining up to come talk to us.
Okay, let's knock them off one after another.
Okay, James DeCook, I think he's maybe trying to talk to here he comes. The Governor Rick Scott came back into the room, but James DeCook, he's running for the Florida State Senate. Let me just double-check with him that he doesn't need – do you need to talk with the governor? No, do you need to talk with him? Yeah, we can wait for you. We can wait on you. Yeah, you come back when you're ready. Okay, I knew that he wanted to talk to, but he looked at me like, hey, didn't even come over. So we've got the guy from the Madison Foundation that's going to just come explain what that is to us. James DeCook's running for state senate, and I can tell you this right now. The Republican that he's trying to take out is not here. When I was campaigning, I never saw him go to anything, hardly anything. And those of us that consider ourselves conservatives and Republicans in Florida here don't like him a whole lot. And he just – the way he wins is nobody's really come up against him in the last several years with a good game plan. But James recently ran for, I think, an assembly seat at the same cycle that I was running in, and he learned a lot just like I learned a lot. And we've been bouncing ideas off each other, and I'm helping his campaign in any way that I can. But this is another guy like Matt Falconer that we talked with earlier that understands how to reduce government expenditures and save us the taxpayer money. He's done it as a consultant in the past in various capacities, working with city managers and mayors and that sort of thing. And the applicability is there at all levels when you're talking about a state, whether it's at the state level, county level, city level, township, et cetera. He's going to be a great asset
Let me just remind everybody, because we're getting up to the top of the hour, and I just want to let those people who might just be joining us, because normally I would be on at from 4 o'clock on. This is Mike Cutler. I've got Tom Garcia joining me today. And Tom, as you know, had been the host of this program, and I've got my own show today, the Michael Cutler Hour. Tom is at CPAC in Florida, the Conservative Political Action Committee in Florida. And we are speaking with folks who are there at this event, and we're trying to get you as many people to listen to who will provide their perspectives on the conservative perspective for America. And, you know, Tom is a conservative. I'm not, but that's fine. We're both Americans, and we're both trying to find the best way to do what's in the best interests of our country and our citizens. And Tom has a powerful voice. He's not only an airline pilot, he was a naval aviator, and he ran for the House of Representatives. How long ago was that, Tom?
I'm sorry, how long was what?
You were the candidate. You were running for...
Yes. I ran in the 2010 election cycle, so it was about a year-and-a-half process, and lost in the primary. There were five of us in that race, and it was a hard-fought race. Not the kind of race I should have gotten into in my very first attempt. It may be very well be my last attempt, but thank goodness we got people like... Well, we got folks like James here who is giving another try, and he's got some experience under his belt now, and I'm pretty confident he's going to pull it off. So what we're going to do, we're going to try something different. He's you know, as a candidate, he's got his magic phone there in his hand at all times. I'm going to have him call in. The number is 310-982-4145. He's just going to call in on his phone, like a lot of our guests do in the past.
Yeah, I'll bring him on as soon as I see his number up on the board here.
He's calling in on, so he's going to call in, and we'll talk to him a little bit about his race and what's going on. And Jim Oddie just walked by. You going to come join us in a little bit?
Oh, no, I'll be right there.
Okay, yeah. Oh boy, we got people coming left and right.
That's excellent.
And, so it's getting busy in here. So we're going to have a busy show. Maybe we'll wind down a little bit, and we can close it out on a more normal basis. But as soon as I see James pop up on the switchboard, I'll bring his microphone up.
Here he is.
And there it is. All right, James, you can hear me. Can you?
Yes.
Yeah.
James, hi. This is Mike Cutler. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm terrific. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you tell my audience a little bit about yourself and the office you're running for, and what your perspective is.
All right. Well, I think one of the different things that we bring to a candidate this year is the fact that I'm a guy who actually has a public administration experience as opposed to some other candidates. So what I'd like to take up to Tallahassee is, you know, the fact that my 15 years experience in public administration, half of that was on the public side, half on the private side. So I've seen it from both sides. I know how to run cities inside and out. Three-time assistant city manager, two-time city manager. Very proud to say, every year, we held our tax rates the same or lower than both reserves and expanded services. Handled hundreds of millions of dollars in low-interest municipal bonds very successfully, and managed over 150 special taxing districts throughout the state of Florida. So I think that's what separates us is, you know,
what's
a candidate
full
up
name
to
again?
Understand.
Let me get your full name out there, first of all.
Sure. It's James D. Cook, but it's spelled D as in dog, E-C-O-C-Q. Tough one to spell, but easy to say.
Okay. And which office are you running for?
I am actually running for Florida Senate 24, which is presently that Altman seat. We have the eastern section of Orange County, 417 East, the lower southeast section of Seminole, and then we kind of branch off, go across the swamp, and we get all the barrier islands, basically all the barrier islands of Brevard. Lion's share is in Brevard County.
Now, you said you were on the other side of the fence. What did you do then? What was that?
Well, actually, I've been on the private side of government as well, where we helped outsource cities. In fact, I'm the only guy I know of that's helped create a city from scratch, from the ground, helped completely outsource that city, and then turn around and help to transition it back to a traditional city. So I've seen all forms of local government inside and out.
That sounds intriguing. Why did you do that? I mean, why did they have to build it from the ground up? Had it been a city that had failed, or what was the background?
No, but, you know, in Florida, you have a lot of unincorporated area that gets developed and eventually becomes high enough density to where they start to need to demand municipal-style services, which are more proactive than or active, period, than the unincorporated county areas, which are more passive. Counties are really set up to just deal with major infrastructure. They're not set up to deal with high crime rates, police, fire, et cetera, et cetera. So at one point or another, your citizens might get together and say, hey, we would like to have better services. And what we do is we base that on the existing tax rates. So when I create a new city, I create it from the standpoint that there will be no increase in taxes. That's the way that we organize it.
And what was the name of that city, by the way? Did you get to name it, or...
No. I'm actually working on one right now as a pro bono in East Orange County. I've got one that I still do pro bono. I've been working on that one 9 years down in Miami-Dade County. That's a tough one. That's North Central Dade. And that's really one that should be a city. But the three cities I worked for were Key Biscayne, Sunny Isles Beach, and then City of Marathon down in Monroe County in the Keys.
And you're a native Floridian?
No, I've been here 22 years, though, so I consider myself a Floridian now. I'm better than half my life I've spent here. So,
where were you from originally?
Born and raised in South Bend, Indiana. 18, I moved down here to go to school, University of Miami. I spent 2 years in Dallas teaching in inner-city schools, which was a fun experience in and of itself, and then came back to do my grad work, and then kind of fell into government. My degrees are in marine biology and coastal zone management. Never intended to get into politics, never intended to be an administrator, but I guess I'm a pretty good bean counter in addition to scientist.
That's interesting. So I guess you're a big fan of SpongeBob.
Actually, you know, it is fun. I do love SpongeBob. I've kind of pushed that on my daughter, but my dad's a bigger fan, so I think that's why I like him all the more.
I just, you have to understand that I just could not resist.
Nice one, Michael.
Well, listen, James, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little feedback. Here we go. Tell us where people can find out more about your campaign and what you're doing for us.
Okay, you can go to jamesdecook.com. That's J-A-M-E-S, D as in dog, E, D as in cat, O, C as in cat, Q as in quail.com. And we are actually going through a little revamp of that site, but it still has all the basic information. Talks about what we stand for, what we're against. It talks about some solutions on there, my background, the history, et cetera, to make donations there, the whole nine yards. So that's probably the best place. You can also find me on Facebook. But my biggest suggestion to anybody is go ahead and Google me, and you'll find 23-plus pages of things I've done over the last 15, 20 years in Florida. You'll find out I'm a real person who's done real things and had real results. And I think that's the best thing you can do with any candidate, Google them.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, when you see how the politics of America has gone, it is refreshing to have somebody with a background of real achievement behind them.
Oh, absolutely. James, I've known James for a while now, and he really is on top of this stuff. But he's got the real experience of doing what we talked about with, you know, a guy like Matt Falconer, and yet he wasn't a government insider, he wasn't an elected official, so he really knows what he's doing. That's what I really like about him. He's real genuine. I've got the spend many opportunities with him when I was campaigning and know him to be true and genuine. And the guy that we're replacing, you missed it, James, I gave a little introduction before. The guy he's replacing, we absolutely want to get rid of. We can't stand him as Republicans. You won't ever see him at an organization, a convention like this. He just doesn't take the time to come out and meet with people and represent us, quite honestly.
To add on that, you know, it's interesting because I just talked to Governor Scott, and I said, hey, Governor Scott, I'm running against that Altman. And he looked at me and said, he sued me, you know. I said, yeah, that's one of the main reasons why I'm running against him. Scott Altman joined with the Democrats to sue Rick to try to force him to take stimulus money for high-speed rail. That doesn't make him much of a fiscal conservative in my mind.
Fascinating.
Okay. Yeah, well, listen, James, you got some other stuff to go do. Thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
You're always welcome coming on the show. Let us know what we can do for you to help you out. And best of luck.
Appreciate it, brother. I really appreciate you having me on, Tom. It's always a pleasure to see you. Thanks again.
It was great speaking with you.
Thanks, James. Yeah. I'll be right back in a moment, Michael.
Okay, that's fine. I just couldn't resist that line about SpongeBob. You know, to me, this is very exciting, folks. I don't think politics has been getting the attention from all of us that it really should have been getting all along. You know, we as a country, as a members of a democracy, get the government we deserve. When we are not involved in our own government, when our citizens are more concerned with who's going to win the, you know, Dancing with the Stars, or who's going to get the pennant in baseball, or who's going to win the Super Bowl, and we ignore our own government, we pay a price for it. We do pay a price. And in a democracy, the whole system is set up with the idea that we are supposed to be involved. That's why when I write commentaries, I always like to end those commentaries by making the statement that democracy is not a spectator sport. Now, it may not be exciting, it may not be glamorous, but the nitty-gritty comes down to whether or not we are able to support ourselves and our families. The nitty-gritty comes down to whether or not our country is able to protect us. You know, we just had the 10th anniversary of 9/11 here in New York City, and I know that it had an impact on the country. But to those of you out there who are not New Yorkers, who are not familiar with this town, New York is my home. I was born and raised in New York. And so on 9/11, it wasn't only my country that was attacked. That's bad enough. This was my city. My neighbors were among those people who were incinerated when those towers collapsed. My neighbors were in that rubble. So when we understand that failings of the government have an immediate and real-world impact on all of us, it's really foolish that we have, in effect, not done our homework. Because that is our homework. That is our responsibility. It may sound kind of cliche to say this, but those brave men and women in the military who put their lives on the line and very often come home injured physically, emotionally, or perhaps both, or maybe they don't come home at all, went in harm's way on our behalf to maintain our liberties, to maintain our rights as Americans. We as Americans have got to do everything in our power to be worthy of those sacrifices by those incredible members of the military. It's not just about lip service. It's about doing it for real. You know, I spoke at an event yesterday in Dayton, Ohio, and I honestly asked these folks, and many are in the military, how many of you people have never sent a letter to a member of Congress or an elected representative? How many have never made a phone call to the office of someone who represents you in government, never written a letter? And I'm going to guess about a third of the hands went up. These are men and women who are in the military putting their lives on the line, but yet who never thought that they should get involved with their own government that may well send them in harm's way. This is kind of wacky when you think about it. We have a responsibility to our government, to our children. We also have a responsibility to ourselves. When we go to restaurants to order food, I have never, ever seen anybody walk into a restaurant and tell a waiter or waitress, just throw some crap on the plate and I'll eat it. Generally, people are very particular about what they will eat. They will walk in and they will say, I want a cheeseburger, but I don't want American cheese, I want Swiss cheese. And I want it medium well. And I want French fries, and I want this, and I want... And they're very, very particular. And if the food comes out and they're not happy with it, they will probably send it back, and if that doesn't do the trick, they will get up and leave. Well, if you don't like what your elected representatives are doing and you're not contacting them, you're not telling them what you expect of them, and I'm no big fan of politics or politicians, but let's be fair about things also. These folks in elected positions are not mind readers. They really aren't. So if we the people fail in our obligation to make those phone calls, to write the letters, to send the emails, to do whatever it is that it takes to get our voices heard, to let them know what concerns us, what disturbs us, what we believe is important, then how do you expect them to know? They can't hear us if we're not speaking. And that's an obligation that not enough of our fellow Americans have met. Too many of us would rather sit home and watch a baseball game than compose a letter or an email to a congressman, a senator, a city councilman, a mayor, whatever. It doesn't
hey,
take
Michael?
Long, but it's something we have to do. Yes, Tom.
I know you're on a roll and you're doing good. Ed Dean is here. He's
okay.
The radio host I told you about before that everybody who's anybody came to talk to him on his show. His show's over now. I'm going to let him plug his show real quick. I can plug it for him. It's eddeanradio.com. eddeanradio.com. This is Michael Cutler. Yeah, say hi to Michael.
Michael, how you doing, brother?
I am terrific, bro. How are you doing
today? I'm
not
going to jam it off, but hey, here's the powerhouse up in New York.
Yeah. Well, we're doing the best that we can to get the word out there. You know, I'm a retired agent, and I'm just trying to get my perspectives. And
I just want to say hi, Mike. It's a pleasure, and let me tell you something. Tom Garcia, one of the best in the state when it comes to political analysis. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you so much,
Ed.
It's a pleasure having you on.
Yeah, Ed, he's the best. He does a great radio show. He said he might be starting a new network, radio network, Florida network. So we'll see where he goes with that. And I frequently go on his show. I'd like to go on more often. I try to get on as much as – I mean, he'd have me on every week, but he's fantastic. So, any case, that was
excellent.
Ed Dean. You got the – and he just got a free book from Susan Bradford. So did Jim Oddie. They were both here. And, Susan, can we take care of this gentleman real quickly? How long do you need? Okay. Susan's talking with these guys and getting photos and all this stuff. We've got a gentleman here from the Madison Foundation, and we want to talk to him about what they're doing and what's going on with the Madison Foundation. Just the name alone, the Madison Foundation. You got to love that.
Absolutely.
So anyways, we'll get him over here and introduce himself. We don't have a headset for you because we weren't planning on doing this, but you're talking to Tom Garcia from the American Hour, and then Michael Cutler. He's in New York. He's running this. We're basically tapping into his radio show, the Michael Cutler Hour. But I wanted to have somebody from your organization come over and talk to us about the Madison Foundation and what you guys are doing, what you're about, and what people ought to know about you. So,
hello.
I'm sorry.
Well, I thought we had it, but I guess we don't.
I know. Next time I'm going to be better prepared, and I'm going to have some extra headsets and microphones, and then we can have lots of people talking. But I'm reading this card, James Madison Institute. It's Robert McClure, the third PhD president and CEO. So we've got the president and CEO of the James Madison Institute here to talk to us. And on the back of it says Trusted Solutions for a Better Florida. So I believe they are a Florida organization, but we'll let him explain just what they do and what they're involved in here in Florida. But I've heard about them for years, and I think they're a constitutionally based organization. But I may be wrong about that. They may be more focused on state issues. So in any case, here's J. Robert McClure.
How are you, sir?
I'm terrific. Happy Friday,
Jay.
Thank you for joining us.
The James Madison Institute is Florida's oldest and largest free market think tank. And while we're based in Tallahassee, we have supporters and members from Key West, Pensacola, and we really seek to do two things. It's pretty simple. Protect liberty at every turn and offer solutions to the issues that Floridians and really Americans face in their own families, with their own lives, with their children and their grandchildren. Issues that affect economic prosperity, protection of private property, those kinds of things. And that's our focus, and that's who we are.
And you're doing this on the state level or the federal level? Or
state. This is all state-oriented, Florida state-oriented, correct?
Yeah. It is, but as I've said in many conversations today, I would argue Florida is perhaps the single most important bellwether state in the union. The demographics of the country are right here in Florida. The debates that we've been having for 20 years here in Florida, they're only getting to now in Washington, D.C. So I would argue that whatever happens here in Florida at the state level has national implications. So I think it's a little bit more than, say, if we were a think tank in Nebraska or Mississippi. Florida is the most important state politically and public policy-wise. And you see that. You saw that in last night's debate. You see it in the energy today. And you see it with the A-list speakers that are here.
Yeah, that's great. Now, what do you think about this sort of renewed push lately to either dumb down or diminish state sovereignty? You see some very well-known political figures in the Democrat Party who are telling us that state sovereignty, state rights are hurting the country, and we need to consolidate more and more power in the federal government.
Right. Well, as I said earlier today, Milton Friedman, the great free market economist, had it right when he said if the federal government were in charge of the Sahara Desert, there'd be a shortage of sand within 5 years. And he's absolutely right. The reality is the federal government could not run and cannot run a one-car funeral. Look at Medicare, Medicaid, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the United States Postal Service, and now we're told that they're really honestly going to get health care right. The reality is that the founders understood, and this truth is still true today, and that is that the states are the laboratories of democracy. The states are where the great action and the great ideas come from, or if they're bad ideas, they go to the states to die. And that's important to understand. If you look at where the action is today, Governor Scott in Florida, Governor Christie in New Jersey, Governor Kasich in Ohio, Governor Walker in Wisconsin, Governor Haley in South Carolina, even Governor Cuomo in New York, even Governor Cuomo looked across the state and saw what was happening in New Jersey, and he understood he could not raise taxes in New York for the first time in many, many years, and he had to cut the state budget. The reality is that the 10th Amendment is alive and well and extremely important, and the states must protect their sovereignty.
Well, I agree as a strict constitutionalist, but Michael, what question do you have for us?
Well, I was going to say, Tip O'Neill used to say that all politics are local anyway. But as a free market guy, where are you on the issue about the failure to secure America's borders?
Okay, that's a good topic. Michael Cutler, 30-year retired INS officer, and he wants to know where you stand on secure borders for states and what rights the states have in securing their borders.
Well, immigration has not traditionally been one of our issues. We focus on economic issues. But having said that, without sounding too flippant, the reality is we must have strong walls and wide gates. And what that essentially means is we must protect our borders. We must the federal government must enforce the laws on the books, which it does not do. And then we must make legal immigration easier, less bureaucratic for use. And so that's essentially my personal position. The James Madison Institute does not take position on immigration, but the reality is this is a new day. We must protect our borders.
Okay, by the way, do you know that we admit over 1.1 million lawful immigrants every year when you talk about wide gates? I think those gates are wide enough at this point, don't you?
Well, as an INS officer, he says wide gates, we allow 1.1 million immigrants, legal immigrants, in a year. And is that something you think that's too much, enough, could be more? What do you think about that?
I honestly have not studied it enough. I need to make an educated, articulate
sure.
position. I need to do a better job of studying that.
I got to tell you, I certainly appreciate the answer because too many people are too quick to shoot from the hip without really knowing where they are or what the issue really involves. So I certainly appreciate that. It's a unique answer.
Well,
it's one that I don't often get.
We'll wrap this up with the president of the Madison Institute by saying, first tell us where people can find out more information, because even if they're not in Florida, this may, as you said, a model for all the rest of the states. And I like the name that you chose, Madison, and Jefferson was a big hero of mine also. They were both big state rights guys, and when you go back and look at the history and what they fought for and what they stood for, it makes a lot more sense than what we're doing today. But where can people find out more about this and even maybe help the cause out?
I'm sure many of your listeners either visit Florida or travel to Florida, or perhaps many of them have, spend half the time year down in Florida. It's www.jamesmadison.org. We're online. We are, as I said, Florida's oldest and largest think tank in the state. We're completely privately funded, thousands of people who believe in liberty. And it's jamesmadison.org.
Awesome. Thank you, sir, for joining us. Appreciate it.
And keep up the good work. Take care.
All right, now I think we're finally ready for Susan Bradford, who wrote the book Lynch. She's been on the show before, and we're just going to let Susan tell us what she's been working on, what's going on. She lives in the Beltway. Inside, do you live inside the Beltway now, or did you move out? She lives inside the Beltway, so she's got a firsthand view of that black, I call it Black City, but not to have anything to do with race, Black City like, a horror movie. But in any case, so I'm just going to let Susan tell us what's going on. Tell us about the book and what's going on with that. It's out in paperback now, and she's been passing some out and autographing them, and it's a fantastic book. We had a fantastic interview when we did that. That was some months ago. So, Susan, tell us about what's going on, and we'll turn the microphone over to you.
So, Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate the opportunity and, of course, the forum to speak about this. The book has actually been reissued. It's now going into a third edition, and which is incorporating a lot of new information, which actually puts the scandal right back in Florida. As the original book revealed, the Abramoff investigation, which involved Republican super lobbyist Jack Abramoff, in a very high-profile corruption scandal, was manufactured by liberal interests aligned with George Soros, which played out in McCain's Senate Indian Affairs Committee, where witnesses were allowed to lie and commit perjury without any repercussions or consequences. And many have asked, why would they do this? And the simple reason, which we came up with at the time, was that he was blocking casinos, and they wanted retribution against him because the investigation was concocted by his rivals, who were essentially trying to pilfer his business. But in a recent development, which I found really fascinating, is that the scandal traces right smack into Florida, going back right to the Sun Cruise debacle, where he tried to purchase the Sun Cruise gaming fleet. At the time, the Sun Cruise was in competition with the Seminole Tribe of Florida for gaming clients. Little did Abramoff know, his future employer, Greenberg Traurig, was representing the Seminole Tribe. And at the time, Abramoff's business partner, who we now know to be a disbarred bankrupt attorney, attempted to purchase Sun Cruise, which was a nine-figure deal for no money down. There are also connections between him and the Seminole Tribe. We do not know to what extent the Seminoles did advise him, but Wells Fargo essentially hatched a fraudulent deal with Kidan, and then essentially left Abramoff holding the bag. Later on, Wells Fargo was picked up as a client by the very lobbyist who had set up Abramoff, and then it went on to make billions of dollars in Indian country. So what we are essentially looking at is a form of economic terrorism where special interests are who are able to fundraise for government officials are using the arms of the government to take out their competition, to eliminate competitors from the marketplace, and they're essentially stifling free enterprise. What I found kind of interesting, this brings you to the new development. The Seminole Tribe, as I stated, was represented by Greenberg Traurig, Abramoff's employer, and also by the very lobbyists who set up Abramoff because they were extremely worried about his alleged exploitation of Indians. But if you can imagine, if they were truly concerned about the tribal clients of Abramoff, why didn't they just walk on over to the hall, walk on over to Greenberg Traurig and raise the complaints specifically with the firm? Why did they have to go through a scandal? But Greenberg Traurig was allegedly complicit. After Abramoff emerged from the Sun Cruise deal, in which he played no part of the fraud, he handed his paperwork over to the firm, which then, to negotiate a settlement, the firm then went ahead and passed his paperwork on to the Department of Justice. And later, the paperwork was used against him. Once Abramoff was out of the way, the Seminole Tribe of Florida, again represented by Greenberg Traurig, went on to negotiate a $1 billion deal. A $1 billion purchase of the Hard Rock franchise. And subsequent to this, the very lobbyists who were representing the Seminoles picked up another Abramoff client, the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan, and tapped that tribe's $1 billion portfolio to finance various deals with the Hard Rock Cafe. So there was an immediate payoff to them. So essentially, they concocted a scheme to do this, for his ouster, which they would then capitalize upon. And within Indian country itself, Greenberg Traurig has been able to tap into a multi-billion-dollar energy market, and there are other, single-source government contracts, which are worth billions of dollars. And essentially, this involves non-compete government contracts or minority preference businesses. You know, tribes are considered minorities since they're Indians. And they were able to, you know, get an inside line into these contracts.
So your
tribes
book basically
are grand money laundering schemes for the neoconservatives and liberals.
Susan? Hello?
Sure thing.
Yeah, no, I understand what you wrote about, and it's exciting stuff. Where is the book available? Hello, Susan.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, Michael. Michael, you can go to my website, which is www.SusanBradford. My name is SusanBradford.org.
Okay.
And you can buy the book there. It's also available on Kindle, on Amazon. So both of those places will have you can buy the book.
All right. And what's the name of the book again?
The name of the book is called Lynched. And the full title is Lynch, the Shocking Story of How the Political Establishment Manufactured a Scandal to Have Republican Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff Removed from Power. And what, you know, most Americans don't realize is that these various special interests are doing this repeatedly. Like, I also looked into the Enron.
Let me ask you a question. Whoa, stop. Hang on. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Here's my question, though. Are you taking the position that Abramoff was blameless? When you say he was removed, was he blameless for what he did?
Was he blameless? I think what he did was not illegal. I think he was culpable in the sense that he was engaged in lobbying, and lobbying, of course, involves the undue influence of, you know, of the federal government. So he was, in a sense, providing a corrupting influence.
Susan, slow down. I want to be able to have a conversation with you. Please listen to me. As an agent, I was not allowed to accept a cup of coffee from anybody, okay? I have a very big problem with the way lobbyists operate. I think a lot of Americans have a very big problem with the way lobbyists operate. Now, as an agent, I wasn't allowed to take a cup of coffee from somebody. Okay. If I went to someone's home because they were the neighbor of a target of an investigation.
Yeah, I should say that even Abramoff regrets being a lobbyist. He was an Orthodox Jew, a very highly principled individual.
That's right.
He believes he never should have been involved in
Does he regret it because he was caught? Do you know how many people I arrested who said to me, boy, am I sorry? And I would say, yes, you're sorry that I'm here, that I have a .40 caliber Beretta and handcuffs and a badge. So was he sorry that he did what he did because he got caught?
Was he sorry that he
thought it was immoral?
That he was engaging in behavior that he did not feel that went against his own principles.
Well, you know, but I have to be honest with
you. Being caught at what? He got caught being a lobbyist, doing what lobbyists do.
Yes,
hey, Michael.
And I think the whole system is as filthy as it gets. I think of lobbying, when it's done the way it all too often is done, as being nothing short of bribery. And coercion.
Right. Well, I think we agree with you both that you know, the whole lobbying prospect, although legal, and what he did, I believe, from what I've read, was all legal, it does leave a bad taste in our mouth. With that said, people are always going to push the limits of the law if the law allows for it. And so what we really need to do is make some changes to the lobbying laws so people don't end up in that position. But I think the real point of the book is to show how not so much his lobbying efforts got him into trouble, but he got a little too far along in his commercial efforts, you know, business efforts, non-lobbying efforts, and folks that didn't like him moving in their business territory then tried to use the fact that he was a lobbyist to smear him. And that's
but
really
did,
kind of what really
yes,
came
but,
out
but,
of it.
But, Tom, didn't he plead guilty?
He pled guilty, did he not? Yeah. And why do you believe he pled guilty, Susan?
I believe he pled guilty as individuals who are under a federal investigation can face a prospect of a life sentence for going up against prosecutors. I don't know if you followed the Kevin Ring case. Kevin Ring was an associate of Jack Abramoff for exercising his First Amendment rights and trying to challenge the allegations against him. The prosecutors recommended a 22-year sentence. And so I think he was afraid that he would wind up in a similar boat. And I think he knew that with all of the evidence out there, with all of the emails he wrote over 500 emails an hour, he thought prosecutors could piece something together, whether it was legitimate or not, and they could make it stick. So he, and if you can imagine, the cost of fighting such a battle would have been, you know, just prohibitive. And so I think he felt that he could not possibly win in these circumstances.
Did you get to interview Abramoff?
No, she didn't actually get to interview Abramoff, and I think you got a little bit of cooperation from him, did you not? But you got to meet him in prison. Okay, so you did. Would he talk about it when you were in prison? Or, yeah, he wasn't allowed to talk about it. And I actually friended him on Facebook and told him that we were going to have Susan Bradford on the show several months ago when we did that, and he friended me back. He sent me like one word, like thanks, you know, but didn't want to discuss anything. Don't know if he came and listened to it, the show or not. So I think, you know, he's probably, my impression is he's a guy that, you know,
one of the things that I've often said, and people tell me that, well, this wouldn't be right under the First Amendment, but wouldn't it be interesting if corporations or people could only donate money to one candidate or the other when they run for office, where today you see people, and especially corporations, donating money to two people running for the same office.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're trying to play at both sides.
And that's what I think disturbs so many people about the political process today.
Yeah. Well, let's ask Susan what she sees going on in D.C. in that regard.
Yep.
Michael asked about people that give donations to two different candidates that might even be running
for
against
the same
each
position.
Other to try and play it both ways and play favorites so that whoever does get elected – they've got some maybe sort of influence. And what are you seeing in D.C. now in that regard?
I think that the most people who do make campaign contributions, at least from the commercial side, are looking for some kind of payout for that. Like they might, you know, donate $100,000. You know, they might get a 100-fold return on their investment in terms of a commercial contract.
On their investment.
So
an interesting word, investment.
They're playing both sides of the fence. They can ensure that whoever wins that position might then turn around and offer them a contract, for which they can get their money back.
So now here's a follow-up. The Supreme Court ruled, I believe it was last year, that corporations can give unlimited amounts of money to pay for campaign ads for political candidates. Doesn't
yes,
that just
and,
make the system
well,
all the more crooked?
The Citizens United ruling. Well, I'll give you my spin on it, and we'll see what Susan has to say. But
absolutely.
If they can't give the money to candidates.
No, but it can pay for advertising, let's say.
And they can, yes, but they cannot also pay for ads that promote a candidate. They can only go against the candidate. So, in other words, if you really dislike Barack Obama, you can run ads that point out what he's not done for us or what you dislike about him. But what you can't do is say, well, I really want to see Herman Cain win and run millions and millions of dollars.
But if Herman Cain, let's
say
Herman Cain becomes the nominee, how much would he be indebted to your company if you did that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, think about the Swift Boat guys that took out ads. And now that was a nonprofit the way they set it up. But if they've been
and you know what's interesting? The candidate could take an oath and say, I'm not going to do any dirty ads.
Right.
Now, think about that. I'm not going to do any dirty ads, but the ABC Corporation goes out there and spends $25 million to beat the hell out of my candidate that I won't speak badly about. And then I can stand there and say, I'm blameless. I didn't do it.
Right. And that is something that I think puts this all in a tough position. But unfortunately, in our country, we consider now corporations to be entities like a person.
And that happened in 1969, didn't it, Tom?
Yes. Yeah. The
and that's,
Court
and that's
that.
What you noticed when all hell broke loose in the political arena.
Right. And so that's what now I can also, though, understand, say, a individual who has a business. And there are politicians that are working to pass laws that harm his business and his industry and him wanting to speak out about it. And if he can't say anything, not as an individual, but as a business, because he's got a business that's going to be harmed, and maybe he works in an industry that's going to be harmed, and he doesn't have the wherewithal to create a PAC and a foundation and all this other stuff. So I see both sides of it, but I understand it's just a slippery slope whichever way you go. But let's ask Susan what she's seeing in D.C. and what
sure.
her take on the Citizens United ruling has really resulted in up to this point. Susan.
I have to say that, you know, campaign finance law is immensely complex. I'm not exactly an expert in it. But I do think one thing that Citizens United did open up, and that it does state that essentially, you are free to express your First Amendment rights by giving to political campaigns. I think that they were afraid that restrictions on campaign funding would, in essence, stifle free speech. Because if you are a corporation or you're a small business person, as Tom said, you may not be able to form a PAC or mobilize yourself to defeat a policy or legislation which could be very detrimental to your business. But you can give money to various candidates who can then take action on your behalf. So essentially, they are trying to free up the process so that they can speak in the form of dollars, unfortunately. On how they would like to weigh in on whatever is before Congress.
I'm curious, Susan, what made you decide to go after the Abramoff case?
That's a good question. I know I've asked that before, but let's see. I'll ask Susan, what made you decide to look at the Abramoff case and write a book about it?
That's a very good question. I think early on when I heard the allegations, from what I was hearing about it, it appeared that what the media was so up in arms about was amounted to traditional lobbying, which they were all very familiar with. And I also was under the impression that they were trying a little bit too hard to sell it. Like they, as opposed to presenting the facts, they wanted to, that they wanted to market his guilt. And so that also raised questions. And at the time, I was working in the interfaith dialogue community, and I knew that Abramoff was among the most principled and ethical lobbyists on Capitol Hill, ironically, and that they were painting him as a villain. And so I wanted to get to the bottom of why were they doing this? What was motivating the opposition to go to such lengths?
And what were your findings? Why do you think they ultimately did this?
Well, it was because he was encroaching on their travel business, their cruise line business. He had come up with a way to, put together their own cruise line business, bring in some ships. And I may not be getting exactly right, but that's the gist of it. And they wanted a monopoly in South Florida. And so they decided to, based on his position, smear him. I mean, it'd be the same story if Michael, you and I were putting together a business in South Florida and somebody wanted to smear me, then they would, because I'm an airline pilot, they'd figure out how can we make him look bad as an airline pilot. Oh, we know that he drinks when he's flying,
right.
And bring up allegations like this and make up some emails and throw those things around. So that was really their motivation, to try and smear him. Not so much his lobbying efforts. Am I getting this right, Susan? But more of his business activity was now encroaching on their business. So very interesting how they used that, the fact that he was a lobbyist, when in fact it really had nothing to do with it. And why did John McCain get involved in all this? Well, because John McCain gets a whole lot of money, support money, from the Indian tribes in Arizona. And a lot of these Indian tribes are, to some degree tied together in their efforts to lobby it, et cetera, and, for the gambling, et cetera.
Okay.
So all of a sudden John McCain comes in here like he's trying to be a tough guy and crack down on lobbyists, when in fact he had lobbyists lobbying him to crack down on the lobbyists. Yeah, it's just all
can't make
corruption.
This. And what was Susan doing before she did this? Before you became an author, what were you?
Directly before this, I was working in interfaith dialogue, developing a few books on how the Abrahamic faith, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism were trying to find elements of commonality and similarity to speak with a united voice on issues of foreign policy, since, there's a great deal of division among them. And before that, I did work as a journalist. I was a producer for Fox News Channel, a news writer for CBS, speech writer for Michael Howard, who's UK Shadow Foreign Secretary, and I was also a speechwriter for the Korean ambassador to the UK. So I've worked both as a journalist. I've worn many hats, I guess, as a journalist and as a writer.
That's interesting, you know, because very often, and, you know, I've done quite a few appearances on TV, radio, and so forth, and a lot of people come away with this idea that the news is not being objective. And I have to be honest, I also very often find that my degree was in communications, arts, and sciences. As an agent, you know, they always hammered it into our head from day one that we're fact finders. And there's a great similarity between what journalists and special agents, investigators, do. Did you ever find that in your prior life working for the networks that there was a bias that came out when you were trying to do stories?
Claire, can you repeat the question again for us there?
Sure. Yeah, what I was saying to Susan is, you know, investigators, as I was as a federal agent, we were investigators certainly, there's a similarity between that and what journalists do. When you were working in television, when you were working for news programs, did you ever find that there was a real bias to the way the news was being presented? Was it conscious, unconscious? Because very often the allegation is made, and I kind of felt that way, that there are certain networks that won't cover certain stories, or when they do cover them, they cover them in a certain way that makes you believe that there's a real bias involved.
That's absolutely true. And in the case of the Abramoff investigation, most of the major networks were represented by lobbying firms, which had actually conspired against Abramoff in the first place. So you can imagine that they either would not cover the story, or if they did, they would report it. They would essentially paint him as a villain. A lot of these networks are also tied into publishing houses, which tend to have a liberal slant. They're involved. They might have parent companies, which are involved in casinos or in defense contracting and so forth. So they have a multitude of special interests and are lobbying for their own business interests on Capitol Hill. So they might have a bias with certain legislators and would further the agenda that those legislators might be promoting in the hopes of getting some other, you know, financial and business goodies down the road. So there's definitely a bias in reporting as a direct result or connection to their own financial interests.
Wow. That's pretty damning. I really think that would make an even – not that this is a bad story. I want to get my hands on that book. But – I think that would make a really interesting topic, don't you?
Yeah. Michael thinks that would make a really interesting topic. Well, we're winding on down here. It's up to you, Michael. This is your show, but I was thinking, let's ask Susan if there's any last things she wants to tell people and remind us.
And by the way, Susan, if you go to my website, and I want to put it out there for the folks also, I'd love to be able to communicate with you off air, but my website is michaelcutler.net. If you'd be kind enough to shoot me an email, Susan, I would love to talk to you.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we'll have her do that.
Or you can give her my contact info. You're there with her, so you can provide that. But I really see so much of how important this is, because nobody knows what's going on in the world except for the news media and the reporters. You know, most of the stories that we become aware of, whether it's the Abramoff case or any other case, isn't something that we know from firsthand. We're relying on the journalists to tell us, otherwise we have no idea that it happened. So the work that you're doing is incredibly important. Is there a website that you have, or do you want to talk about where the book can be purchased or anything else that you would want to put out there, Susan?
Yeah, she's going to give us that right now, and then I see another senatorial candidate sitting at
Super.
Guess who's sitting right next to me doing the broadcasting? Mark Bernier.
Oh, wow. Tell Mark I say hello. Yeah. He's an old friend. I've been on his show so many times.
Right, yeah. And I told him that you and I were doing this today, and he said, oh, Michael Cutler in New York. Okay. So he's talking with Dion Long, and I don't know if we're going to have time to get Dion. If Dion gets off before the end of the show, we'll at least let him jump on here and give us his website information, and then you can close out the show. But I'll hand it back to Susan one last time to let us know where we can – find out more information about you, your book, and where can people purchase it?
Thank you so much. You can you can go to my website, which again is www.susanbradford.org. The book is called Lynched, the shocking story of how the political establishment manufactured a scandal to have Republican super lobbyist Jack Abramoff removed from power. The book is available on Amazon, also on Kindle download, or you can also buy the book. I think this book is very important, not only to learn about what happened to Abramoff, but to understand the patterns of behavior, because a number of the same patterns have been involved in other alleged corruption scandals, and these various liberal interests are also aligning to take out other conservative candidates and figures. So I think it's important for us to learn how this is happening so we can prevent this very damaging pattern from repeating itself.
All right. Well, thanks, Susan. We appreciate that very much.
Great interview. Thank you, Susan. Thanks for bringing her on with us today. Very, very fascinating. But don't you agree? I mean, we are not there when these things happen. You know, breaking news, and sometimes it's a car chase in a little town somewhere, and that'll get 10 minutes of news, but a major national story gets 2 minutes. It's kind of amazing how the news gets reported these days, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, guess who we've got here? Grover Norquist of the tax reform thing in D.C. I'm going to let him just kind of run with it and tell us what he talked to us about, what he's doing, what he sees happening, and give him just a couple minutes. And Susan Bradford actually knows him fairly well, so
I would imagine.
Yeah, Grover, thanks for coming on over. Michael Cutler's broadcasting in New York, and I apologize. We were going to do this all totally mobile. And then they gave me a nice table here. I didn't bring another headset or anything, so I'll just basically tell you, Michael Cutler, 30-year INS officer. We had some nice discussion today about how immigration is affecting taxes, et cetera. You're heavily involved in the taxation issue and stopping taxation, and I think you get a lot of credit, quite honestly, for what's been going on in Washington to stop raising taxes, et cetera. Just give us a little rundown on where people can find out more information about what you've been working on, what you see coming on down the pike, and what people need to be aware of.
At Americans for Tax Reform's website, HER.org, we have a couple of things that would be interesting to people. One is the list of all congressmen and senators who signed the pledge never to raise taxes, and all the state legislators. So it's about 240 members of the U.S. House, a majority, signed the pledge, 41, enough to filibuster in the Senate, over 1,200 state legislators, 13 governors. So we got a very good group to block tax increases at the national level and at the state level. Now, the Democrats keep coming back trying to raise taxes in different ways. Over the last year and a half, it was, gee, we have a lot of debt and deficit. Where could that have come from? We must fix this. Let's raise taxes. And we said, no, we need to fix it. Spend less. You're spending too much. The problem, the way to solve the spend too much problem is to spend less. Raising taxes doesn't solve the spending problem. It enables the spending problem. It encourages the spending problem. But it doesn't fix the spending problem. Only cutting spending fixes that. And if you allow tax increases to be part of any piece of legislation or deal, tax increases crowd out spending restraint. Because if you have a $2.5 trillion problem and you cut spending $2.5 trillion, you don't have any tax increase. But if you have $1 trillion of tax increase, guess what? You'll have $1 trillion less in spending restraint. So that was the old argument. The new argument is we ought to have tax reform, says the president. But he will veto any tax reform that doesn't raise $1 or $2 trillion. So what he wants to do is use tax reform the way he used debt, as fixing the debt, as a Trojan horse to carry tax increases into the city. And he thinks we'll be too stupid to notice this. Now, we weren't too stupid to notice this in the budget fight, and I don't think we're stupid enough not to notice it in the tax reform fight. Raising taxes by eliminating deductions and credits and spending that money not only undermines the effort to reduce spending, it undermines the effort to have tax reform. Because there are a lot of deductions and credits we need to get rid of so the rates can come down. If you get rid of half of those deductions and credits and give the money to the appropriators, they spend it. Then when you go, okay, and now we'll do tax reform, they go, oh, we'd love to help you, but we can't really reduce rates much because we've spent all of the deductions and credits that we were getting rid of before. So we want to make sure any deduction or credit that you get rid of allows you to reduce the corporate and the individual tax rate, not get spent. So that's the big fight. One, don't let them trick us into a tax increase because it interferes with cutting spending and it interferes with tax reform. We need to both cut spending and do tax reform. Tax increases get in the way of both.
Well, that's
great explanation, and that's what we needed to hear. Thanks for stopping by. Now tell us where people can find out more about what you are specifically doing. And I think you've got a website, don't you? It has great articles and information and news and all that stuff.
Sure. HER.org. It's Americans for Tax Reform's website, HER.org. I tweet at Grover Norquist. That's one I like to get a lot of information out of tweeting. But the HER.org website really does have the best information on what's happening in taxes.
Yeah, okay. I actually follow your tweets, and there's some good stuff in there. I always appreciate that. Hey, thank you for taking some time to talk to us for a few minutes. Appreciate it, Grover. Keep up the good work. Thanks. Well, Michael, I know we've got only a couple minutes left.
Right.
And Dion just got off of the radio with Mark Bernier. If we can get him on for about 2 minutes, and that'll give you, I think, about 3 minutes to close out the show, we appreciate it.
That'd be perfect.
Oh, wow, we've been going gangbusters. Boy, I didn't think we'd get this many people showing up today, but
well,
we did.
Well, you must have a good hook. You're grabbing them and dragging them over. I know exactly what you're doing.
Well, I'm kind of in my my old backyard
Tommy the
right
hook.
Here. But,
we're going to call you Tommy the Hook from now on.
Have a seat. Listen, we were going to do this totally mobile, and I have to keep apologizing to people. They gave us this nice table, but then I didn't have another set of headset. Michael Cutler's up in New York running the whole show. And I've got one microphone. So what I'm going to do is say you're running for the U.S. Senate here in Florida. I consider you a good friend. You ran a good, tough campaign in the congressional campaign, and I'm sure you learned a lot. And you've got some good game plan going here and ready to do some good stuff. So tell people where they can find out more about you and what they can do to help you and anything else you want to tell us. We've got about 2 minutes left in the show to do that. I know it's not a lot, and we've had you on the show. People can go back and look for you. We'll have you on the show again, obviously, since you're running again. But let us know what people can do to find out more about you and help out.
Yes, sir. I'm just getting in the Senate race, and our website's going to go up. It's going to be www.deonlong.org. And so that should be coming up in the next week or two. And we're in the Senate race, and it's a big state, and we're out there. Once we get the website up, I want people to come in and check us out, and they'll see that our primary thing for the fair tax, for a balanced budget amendment, for getting back on the gold standard, and also for putting in a free trade regime. And those are the things, and we think that message is resonating with people, and we'll be entering the debates, and we're looking forward to a hard-fought campaign. And I appreciate, you know, Tom, you letting me come in here. You know, you were my favorite candidate other than myself when we ran the congressional race. Matter of fact, the reason I came in last was because Tom was taking – we were fishing out of the same pool of voters or whatever, which were people who believed in the Constitution and believed in limited constitutional government. So, anyway, but I appreciate the opportunity, my friend.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely have you back on the show. And Dion is a wealth of information when it comes to fiscal responsibility and how to get our house in order. You can hear him talk about stuff that you won't hear other candidates talk about. So I always love listening to Dion speak. The very first time I saw you speak, I thought, wow, this guy is smart. And no, he sounds different than me. The guy is smart, and he's talking about things that nobody else is talking about. So in any case, well, Dion, thanks for coming by. We're down like the last couple minutes of the show, and I'm going to let Michael sign off, but we'll have you back on the show, and appreciate getting to see you again. Good luck, my friend.
Well, Tom, here we go. It was a quick 2 hours, you know. It really goes quickly. Usually I do an hour. We're going to be shifting time schedules. I have to work that out with Tom, and I will keep you folks out there apprised. I think we're looking at a 7 to 8 p.m. Shift in the hours for the Michael Cutler Hour. Are we doing that next week, Tom?
Yes, from now on, you get the 7
okay,
to 8
well,
o'clock
so there you go,
slot.
Folks. So now you have the word. Now it's official because Tom is the guy that makes all this magic happen. Look for me at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time next Friday evening at the same place. It's a thrill to spend a couple of hours with you today and to join Tom, who's a good friend and the guy that started this whole business. Radio is the place where we, the people, do get to peaceably assemble. I try to be as peaceable about this as possible, but I also welcome debate. And you could tell your friends that if they want to call in, and the number for you to write down to call in is 310-982-4145. Call in, listen to the program. I want to engage you in this because this is about Americans getting together, getting their voices heard, and trying to cover the information that the networks won't cover. So it's really been a joy to join all of you today. Tom, it's been great having you on. And I wish everybody out there a wonderful weekend. Tom, do you have any final words? By the way, let me just put my website out there one more time, michaelcutler.net or capsweb.org. Tom Garcia?
Yeah, and you can always find my website in the network where we've got you and me and some other hosts there like Steve Rosenblum at just go to tomgarcia.com. That's the easiest way to find it. It's got another address, but it'll take you right there. Go to tomgarcia.com. Michael, it's been a blast. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, my friend.
For helping out with the CPAC here, and we'll do this again sometime in the future, only we'll have some couple extra headsets.
Absolutely. So we won't be flying completely blind. You know, we've been flying under IFR conditions, doing it VFR, and it doesn't work as well as we'd like it to. It worked, but I think we can do it even better. And it really was joyful having you with me today. Folks, I wish all of you a terrific weekend. Please remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get involved in the process. Make certain that the politicians get to hear from you. That's a responsibility that we, the people, most certainly have. Goodbye, everybody. See you next week.